The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning California time Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements and then on to our program. If you would like to call us, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Please do be patient. Let it ring. We'll answer and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also send us comments and questions via email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Please do note that we are copyrighted and trademarked, but of course you do have permission to download our shows and to distribute them. Please don't do anything commercial with them, no edits for private YouTube channels or even for your own website. And remember that we don't do written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. And if you do have any ideas for a specific space show program, please get a hold of me by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we appreciate your following these pretty simple guidelines. In addition, you can find our podcast, and we do thank Andrew over at gigadial.net. So the RSS URL to subscribe is on our website and in both of our newsletters. You can find us in iTunes, Microsoft, Zoom, and a host of other places as well. If you have any questions or comments, go ahead and email me again at drspace@thespaceshow.com. That is our website, thespaceshow.com, and our detailed comprehensive newsletter is there. It goes up every Sunday evening, California time, and it has all of the details of the week's programming, guest bios, and it is the only place where there's a future events section. And then when we have to change or modify our schedule, which does happen from time to time, we do it first on the website newsletter, so please do check it out and stay current by looking at it every once in a while. And if you want the very short email newsletter sent to you, just request it at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived on our website, so you can go back to the beginning in 2001. We're only about 9 shows away from having 2,000 programs, and they're all available on our website or as an easy download. And if you have any questions about any of that, just go ahead and send me a note, and I'll do my best to respond to you. On the website, not only are the archives there, but you'll see a guest search tool next to the social media button. So you can search there like you could in any Word document or PDF or Excel, and you can pull up all of the favorite keywords that you might search for, like Mars, or favorite guest, and then you'll get the dates where that was discussed or that person was on the show, and then you can pull those programs up by dates using the Space Show search engine at the bottom of our Space Show website. There is a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top, Space Show Gear. Of course, probably the most important button is support the Space Show. We are a nonprofit 501c3 with one GiantLeapFoundation.org, and your contributions and support make the Space Show possible. And we thank all of you who have supported us and will be supporting us in the future. And if you have any questions about that, again, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Finally, do remember that we are partially sponsored and brought to you by Secure World Foundation. And they promote cooperative solutions for space security, and you can get much more information from them at their website, www.swfound.org. And if you have any questions about that, just, again, let me hear from you. They also sponsor our webinar series, and we're most appreciative of that support. And that brings me to today's program. So I'm very happy to bring back Marcia Smith. And Marcia is the president of Space and Technology Policy Group in Arlington, Virginia, which specializes in policy analysis of civil, military, commercial space programs and other technology areas. She's the founder and editor of SpacePolicyOnline.com, which is where you go to find out all the news that's happening with our government, our space program, NASA, etc. She does an outstanding job of bringing that to us in factual format. From March of 06 to 09, she was also director of the Space Studies Board and the National Research Council, and from January 2007 to 2009, additionally was director of the NRC's Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board. And for those of you who probably are not aware, the NRC is the operating arm of the National Academies, comprised of the NRC, the National Academies of Science, National Academies of Engineering, and the Institute of Medicine. Her full bio is on the webpage, so we can talk to Marcia Smith rather than read about her. She is going to be our tour guide today through the jungle of sequestration, financing, budgets, NASA, you name it. And also, we are celebrating 50-plus years of human spaceflight with Yuri Gagarin's flight, I think 52 years ago today, given that this is April 12th. Marcia Smith, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm just fine, and happy Cosmonautics Day to you as well.
And if you look over 52 years, well, I guess we're making progress, right? You know, we're human spaceflight, at least in LEO, is pretty much routine, I think, or at least it's a lot more routine than it's ever been before.
Yes, it certainly has been an interesting path. You know, in the beginning, we went one way and the Soviets went another way, so we headed off to the moon and the Soviets didn't get there, and so they focused on Earth orbit. And then we sort of did our bit with the moon, and now we're focused on Earth orbit, and now we're working together with the Soviets. So things certainly have changed over those 52 years, but I would say that human spaceflight is fairly routine these days, as evidenced by the fact that the public doesn't seem to pay a whole lot of attention to the space station, even though there's so much interesting stuff going on up there.
You know, that's part of the problem. When you do it well and you make it routine, it's for the most part off the headlines.
Exactly.
And I guess that shows up in the budget process, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not so sure. The space station is well funded in the budget proposal, and it's actually a little surprising at how much the space station still costs. It's, you know, $3 to $4 billion a year. Almost as much as the shuttle was when it was operational, and that wasn't the plan in the beginning, but of course the beginning was a long time ago for the space station program. It took 25 years to build it, and although they talked then about an operational cost of like $1 to $1.5 billion, if you just added inflation since then, you'd probably get up to $3 billion. So it's an expensive program to operate. NASA now talks about it as being the centerpiece of their human exploration program for the near-term future, because it's going to take a while before they get Orion and the Space Launch System up and operating. So they are trying with all their might to demonstrate the utility of this facility that the U.S. and Russia and Canada and Europe and Japan have all spent so much time and effort on.
So the U.S. pays the lion's share of the station. Do you know the percentage of what the United States is paying in that partnership?
No, it's very hard to calculate because the partners contribute in-kind services. And I know there is someone somewhere who is calculating how much the cost of a Japanese HTV launches and a European ATV launches to make certain that everybody's, quote-unquote, paying their fair share, but it's not an actual transfer of money.
So
the U.S. is paying, you know, money into space station operations, and the other partners are contributing to operations, but they spend their own money in their own countries. But the only exception, of course, is that we do send money to Russia to launch our astronauts.
Interesting system. How do we stand in for the 2013-2014 budget process with NASA? Because I know it's really confusing, and we kind of kidded around a little bit before the show started. But clearly, you must have some better idea than most of us do about what's happening.
Oh, boy, I wish I did, actually. It's very confusing even sitting here inside the Beltway, as they say. And 13 is just this big mystery. NASA and the other agencies did not announce this week how much they actually got for the current fiscal year. They're still sorting all that out because the congressional action was so delayed. So even though they know what they had in fiscal 2012, and they know what they're asking for fiscal 14, but they're still doing the math to figure out how much they've got to spend for the current year. So that really complicates things, because usually when you do these budget analyses, you look at what programs are getting more money, what are getting less money, and you do those kinds of comparisons, but you really can't do that this time because the 13 numbers are not known, and they had to put something in that column. And so the agencies were told to use this number, which is just going to confuse everybody in their fiscal 13 columns in their budgets, because it refers to a continuing resolution, but it was to the first one, not to the final one, that actually cut everybody's budget so much. So it's very, very difficult to sort out for everybody, including the agencies.
But we already have 2014 proposed, and 2013 it's not settled, or it's just hard to understand, and it is settled, or it's still going to vary and fluctuate between now and the end of the fiscal year.
Well, again, you know, stop me if I start driving you crazy with all the terminology and everything, because it's really hard to follow. But Congress has completed action on the 13 budget. But what they did was they put a lot of very specific numbers in something called an explanatory statement. And so you can look in this explanatory statement, it's on the web, and see all these numbers for NASA that look really good. But then you have to know that you have to read the entire bill. And when you get to the very end of the bill, it talks about all these across-the-board cuts they're making. So any number that you see in that table for NASA or for any of the other agencies, you have to look at the end of the bill and see how much money Congress is then taking away from those numbers. So there's one section back there, section 3001, that has rescissions. And a rescission is basically taking money away. You gave money, and now you're bringing it back, and that's a rescission. And so for NASA, that part of the bill got a 1.877% rescission from all those numbers. And then there's another section, and it says, well, we've still got the sequester. Well, that's another 5% cut. And then there's another section that says, it tells the White House Office of Management and Budget to add up everything in the bill that Congress agreed to, and if it was over a certain limit that they'd agreed upon, then OMB was to do another cut across the board to everybody to get the top line down to where they wanted it to be. And so that's another cut. So you've really got to keep connecting all these dots, and sometimes you don't even know where the dots are, to find out what the total is that you need to take off of those numbers that look so good. And so it is roughly 7% that you need to take off of those numbers. And that is settled. I mean, the law has been passed. It's been signed into law. And so that is settled. But agencies have a little bit of flexibility in terms of transferring funds. So NASA has not even announced the total amount of money that it got for fiscal 13. It's roughly $16.6 billion. But there can be some variation. That exact number is not settled yet. But it's roughly $16.6 billion. So it's about a $1 billion cut from what they requested. And until we all get to see how they absorb that cut, it's really hard to know what impact that has on all of NASA's programs. Presumably, you can't just take $1 billion out of NASA and just keep moving on as though nothing happened. But if you listen to NASA, and again, I'm not singling out NASA, it's true with all the agencies, they're just acting like it never happened, but it did happen. And we're going to find out on May 10th how all those numbers worked out, because the agencies have to submit what are called operating plans to Congress by May 10th. And then we'll be able to make some comparisons between what they had, what they now have, and what they're asking for 14.
So when May 10th comes along, that's when they have to end their thinking it didn't exist, right?
for 13.
For 20.
But they are still pretending it doesn't exist for 14. The administration's, so this sequester thing that everybody was so focused on for the current fiscal year, and the fiscal cliff and all that, oh, you know, sequesters. So the sequester, it actually runs through 2021. It's a 10-year budget plan, and every year there's a sequester. And the Obama administration does not agree with the sequester. And so they are not factoring that into the budget request for 14. So they're still pretending the sequester doesn't exist for the 14 requests.
Okay, but since it does exist and it's in law...
For 13.
But it's in law for 2014 unless they repeal it, right?
Yeah, so the Budget Control Act that set up this whole sequester in 2011 is a 10-year law and goes through 2021. So the fact that there is a sequester is in law. But the numbers that they were working on for this fiscal cliff and everything really were just for fiscal 13, the current fiscal year.
So I guess to us mere mortals out here, how do you pretend and just overlook that the law is there, or do you make the assumption that it will get repealed? And then
you make the assumption that your guy, in this case President Obama, is going to prevail and get Congress to agree to a different way of cutting the deficit. And this has been the fight all along, because President Obama wants to cut the deficit by a combination of tax increases and spending cuts, and the Republicans want to reduce the deficit only by spending cuts. And this fight's been going on for 2 years now, and it's still going on. There's a little bit of a breather right now because they finally got through with 2013, and so now they're gearing up again for 2014.
So I'm not a political guru by any means, but I wouldn't think that they would expect a resolution on this before the 2014 elections, because each party is running on their position, so to speak.
Right.
So at what point do these people have to face reality and deal with the fact that the law is probably not being changed for 2014?
Well, I mean, they didn't do it for 2013 until the very last minute. I think literally until the final hours before Congress agreed to that final continuing resolution. There were a lot of people who thought that Congress would back down on the sequester, and they didn't.
So where does this, I mean, you know, NASA's, there's all these policies out there and programs that are, you know, being carried on and will need funding. Some of the more traditional ones, of course, are in play, you know, like continuation of some of the space sciences and the missions that are already ongoing, like Cassini and Curiosity, and then you've got James Webb, which is still getting money in the space station, and SLS and Orion are still getting funded, and now we're seeing we're going to go out and capture an asteroid, so we need to do a $105 million concept study, I guess, to lead that off. How does it all, I mean, it's just, one, it seems that it's not adding up. I mean, I don't even know the words to ask you the question. At some point, something has to match reality, I guess.
Yeah. And I wish I knew where that was, because I don't know either, even though I follow this day by day.
So don't the NASA people... I mean, so what is the process for NASA, within NASA, to plan their budget? I mean, a lot of people say Congress is micromanaging NASA's budget, but actually the allocation to all of the different things that NASA does comes from within NASA itself, correct?
No, it comes up. Actually, NASA puts a proposal forward, but it's really decided by the White House Office of Management and Budget.
So they are micromanaging.
OMB decides, you know, how NASA can allocate its money and how much money it can ask for.
Okay. So NASA puts forth its proposal
to the White House.
For the White House.
Because NASA is part of the administration.
Right.
So they report to the White House. And this part of the White House, called the Office of Management and Budget, oversees all of the government spending. And they tell NASA, nope, sorry, you can't have this much money. You can only have this much money. Or you need to spend more on this and not so much on that. And they work it all out over a period of many months. And if NASA really doesn't like what OMB is telling them, then the head of NASA can go to presumably the president himself, but I think he usually goes to the head of the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, and they try to get a better answer. But sooner or later, it comes out as the president's budget request. NASA is part of the president's budget request. And that president's budget request that has gone through OMB is what is submitted to Congress to work on. And then Congress makes the final decisions. But there's always some flexibility in those things. So agencies usually are given a small amount of transfer authority. They can't make wholesale changes in what Congress has decided. But they can transfer, you know, a small percentage from one program to another as long as they inform Congress of it and all that.
So, in theory, NASA could propose cutting commercial crew significantly and adding more money to SLS and Orion to speed it up, and OMB could say, we're not going to let you do that, and this is what you have to do instead, correct?
Right.
Which is what happens, but...
Well, I don't know in that particular case.
Right.
NASA can propose an asteroid retrieval mission, and OMB can say no. Or OMB can tell NASA, you will do an asteroid retrieval mission. So, I mean, OMB is the entity that NASA has to go through to get its budget approved at the first level, and then Congress makes the final decision.
And how often does Congress override or overrule OMB?
So they do it, you know, sort of in a small sense. For example, NASA headquarters has not been as enthusiastic about a Europa mission as Congress has been, because there's a member of Congress who is very close to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and thinks that Europa is a good thing to do. And so they will say, you know, NASA, you will spend this much money on studies of your Europa mission, even though that was not in the NASA budget request. So that's sort of on a smaller scale. But, I mean, the big difference came in the fiscal 2011 budget, which was influenced by the 2010 NASA Authorization Act, where NASA and OMB and the White House did not want to build a new big rocket and spacecraft, and Congress said, you will build a big rocket called the Space Launch System and a spacecraft, which is Orion. So in that case, you know, that was a real policy battle between the administration and Congress, and they came to a compromise on it because, you know, the White House wanted to do commercial crew, and Congress didn't want that, but they allowed the administration to do it. It's very messy because now you end up with Congress telling NASA what to do and the White House telling NASA what to do, but NASA's not being given the money it needs to accomplish all of that. And that's one of the many reasons why funding is so tight at NASA.
You have a question from one of my students at North Dakota, so let me go ahead and introduce this. This is from Josh, and he said, is there going to be a NASA Authorization Act to replace the one that expires this year? How does it fit into the budget process being negotiated in the months ahead? So we sort of have talked about this, but this is a little bit more specific.
So... There, just for everybody who doesn't follow this closely, there are two processes in Congress as to how agencies get funded. One is called an authorization process, and one is called an appropriations process. So NASA gets authorized. It's permitted to do things through the Authorization Act. And there was an Authorization Act enacted in 2010 that was for 3 years. And that's what everybody has in their mind, that it's for 3 years, and the 3 years are up, and therefore it expires. But it's important to bear in mind that the only thing that really expires are the funding recommendations. So they had funding recommendations in there for fiscal 11, fiscal 12, and fiscal 13, and that's it. But all the policy stuff that's in there, that remains law forever. If you never passed another NASA Authorization Act, the policy that's in the 2010 Act would still stand. So the only reason you need a new act is if you want to recommend funding levels for fiscal 14 and beyond, or if you want to change something about the policy that's stated in the 2010 Act. So from everything I hear, there is an intent on both the House and the Senate sides to do a new NASA Authorization Act. But I think everybody knows just how difficult it's been for Congress to pass legislation of any kind, and whether a NASA Authorization Act gets the kind of attention that it needs is an open question.
And it would have to be passed before September 30th?
Conceptually. I mean, that's not the way things actually work, because they don't get the appropriations bills done by September 30th. But if so, as I mentioned, there's authorizations and there's appropriations. And the appropriations are the bills that actually give money to agencies. All the authorizers do is they recommend funding levels. But authorizing committees don't have any money to spend. Only appropriating committees have money to spend. So the way it's supposed to work is the authorizers, who know the details of an agency's program, you know, they've done a lot of hearings on it, and they know all these individual programs, and so they say, you should spend $5 on this program. But it's the appropriators who actually have the money to spend, and they have to trade that off amongst all the agencies under their jurisdiction. So NASA's in there with the National Science Foundation and the Department of Commerce and the Department of Justice and all those things. And so the appropriators need to divide up the money. And they may say, well, you know, we don't really have $5 to spend on that program. We can only give you $450. And it, conceptually, they are not supposed to give more than an authorizing committee has recommended. They do, but they're not supposed to. So that's the way the process works. So you have one set of committees that really know the details, they really know the policy, and they recommend funding levels, and that is supposed to influence the appropriators, who are not supposed to set policy. They are simply supposed to make funding decisions. But if you don't have an authorization bill, that doesn't prevent the appropriators from giving money. They just don't have the benefit of the recommendations of the authorizers.
Here's another listener email from you, from Jane in Boston. And Jane said, given all of the uncertainties on the budget side for NASA and all of the hoops that one has to go through between NASA, the White House, and Congress, how serious do you think their new asteroid retrieval mission is for $105 million for some sort of concept study?
So the $105 million, and this is very confusing, and I do think that NASA did not do a very persuasive job on Wednesday rolling this out. And, of course, it had been rumored before then, so people have known about it for, you know, a couple of weeks. But I think that they have not done a good job of explaining what the money is for or how this mission fits into their overall plan for human spaceflight or for science or for whatever. And I think there are going to be many questions about it as Congress deals with this budget request. But NASA talks about an asteroid retrieval mission and an asteroid retrieval initiative, and it's the initiative that there's $105 million for. And there's a part of that, $78 million, and that's the number that you'll see in all the White House budget statements. If you go on the OMB website and you call up the NASA part of the budget, it will say there's $78 million in the NASA budget request for an asteroid retrieval mission. And so that's money that NASA wants to put into a concept study and into accelerating the development of solar electric propulsion. So that's not a study. That's actually advancing technology. And then they want to spend $20 million more. So this is a plus-up of $20 million for trying to find asteroids. So they're already planning to spend $20, and now they're going to add $20. So it's not that it's $105 million for a concept study. It's about $40 million of that will be used to try and figure out exactly how they would do this mission and to start looking at the kind of technologies you would need to actually grab onto an asteroid.
So
how real is it?
I don't know.
It doesn't have a run-out cost associated with it, because NASA says they're very early in trying to figure out how to do this. And one almost has to ask the question is why they're rolling this out now when they haven't had a chance to really understand it. Ordinarily, you would do some sort of preliminary study of something before you would announce it as a new initiative. And all they have right now, as I understand it, is the study that was done last year by the Keck Institute of Space Studies, which is a really interesting report. It's only about 50 pages long. You can find it on the web. And they talk about this asteroid retrieval mission, and they come up with a cost estimate of $2.6 billion. And that's just a cost estimate that was done by Glenn Research Center. So it's not been subjected to an independent cost estimate, and NASA often has the Aerospace Corporation come in as sort of an independent body to look at some of these cost estimates. So there's not a lot of credibility, I think, with a $2.6 billion estimate. And so NASA really, they've decided they're going to do this. They're going to do it faster than what the KISS, people call it the KISS study, said they should do it. And they even said on Wednesday that they didn't think it was going to cost as much as the KISS study recommended. And I just, you know, personally feel, with all due respect to everyone involved, that that's just not credible.
They have a cool video that they've now put out there that is on YouTube for people to see. That Marshall Space Flight Center put out.
You know, they used to talk about ViewGraph programs that only exist in ViewGraph, so now it's the YouTube video programs.
Yeah, so they do have a YouTube video that is out there that's 4.5 minutes long, and listeners, I'm sure you can find it, or I guess you can email me and I can tell you where it is if you want to see it. Do we know where is there any way to know where, say, the $105 million comes from? Is it new money, or do they take it from an existing program?
And that's a very interesting question. Until we know what happened in 13, we don't know how to make the comparisons to find out who the winners or losers were in 14 overall. But NASA's chief financial officer, Beth Robinson, was asked this question at a budget briefing, and the transcript of that budget briefing is on NASA's budget website already. And you can see where she says that this is new money. And so nobody lost anything. She says, you know, this is new money, and if it were not for this initiative, then we wouldn't have gotten the $105 million at all. But on the other hand, NASA's being flat-funded at $7.7 billion. I mean, this is what they've been projecting for some time, and it's still $17.7 billion. So I'm still confused as to how this could be new money, because it's still within that 17.7 cap, if you will. So I don't understand how there cannot be someone who is losing because they are spending this money on the initiative.
In December, the National Research Council, you know, published their report on NASA. And
yes, and in the interest of full disclosure, I was a member of that committee.
Okay, and I did a show with the PI, Dr. Carnesale, I think I'm pronouncing it right, from UCLA.
Yes.
And that study shows that there is, to be polite, I guess, an enormous amount of confusion about the asteroid mission within NASA itself. Is that sort of a fair and polite way of saying it?
And that was the previous mission.
Right.
The one that was announced 3 years ago by President Obama to send astronauts to an asteroid by 2025.
So we're wondering if that mission to send asteroids by 2025, if this new initiative is in support of that mission, which that report says is totally confusing and without a lot of support or organization within NASA, or are we looking at yet another asteroid program within NASA that's not related to the one that was supposed to be their mandate from the White House 3 years ago?
I myself am confused as to whether or not this new one replaces the 2025 mission or is an addition to the 2025 mission. But NASA Administrator Bolden makes absolutely clear that this is part of President Obama's overall plan to send people to an asteroid and on to Mars. So whether this is now a three-step process or still a two-step process, I'm not clear about.
But you are clear that there's a lot of confusion out there.
I am clear that it's very unclear.
Bruce sent in an email. Is there any movement or changes in public-private partnerships for space projects in the United States, and how are they administered? Is there a financial hurdle or stress test to participate with the government, specifically NASA, for space projects? And does anything like that show up in any of the budget information? Do they have any kind of funding or program or support for public-private partnerships or anything like that?
Well, the commercial cargo and commercial crew programs, even though they're called commercial, they really are a public-private partnership. And I think that NASA is looking for more public-private partnerships. And they have a lot of Space Act agreements with people, and sometimes NASA provides services like allowing them to use the tracking and data system, the Deep Space Network, that kind of stuff. And sometimes, you know, NASA actually gives them money. So there are a whole variety of different mechanisms that NASA uses. And I think that they are very interested these days in public-private partnerships.
But there's nothing formal through the budget process or anything like that in general for that that subject or that direction.
Well, again, the commercial cargo and commercial crew, I think, both, in my mind, get categorized as public-private partnerships, and they are in the budget.
Do we have any information? I hear from a lot of listeners that they're always worried that commercial crew is going to be robbed, especially for SLS and Orion. So are you able to tell anything about the security of funding to commercial crew?
No, and of course they did get cut in 13.
Right.
The request was 830 and Congress gave them 525, but that 525 probably, not definitively, but probably is subject to the 7% cut. But that's one of the things that's not clear yet, because there is some discretion as to how they do those cuts. So I don't know what the number is going to turn out to be, but the most it will be is 525. So they're now asking for 800 and it's around 830 again for fiscal 14, and they are emphasizing as strongly as they can that if they don't get that money, then they will not have a commercial crew capability by 2017. So that's it. You know, if Congress doesn't give them the money, then the 2017 date is going to slip, and they're just making certain that everybody knows that.
By the way, that video that I mentioned that's on YouTube for the asteroid retrieval, toward the end they show a rocket launch taking crews up to, I guess, do something with the captured asteroid. And then they show you leaving the rocket and going out in the capsule, and then the capsule returning to splashdown. And then the last slide of the movie says that the rocket launch and capsule you're seeing are SLS and Orion. So they're clearly considering that these programs are not going to be cut back or canceled, I guess, at least in terms of their animation department.
Oh, that's correct. And they, NASA was making clear that this asteroid retrieval mission, that they want to do it in 2021, which is faster than what the KISS study said. And it would be that first crewed launch of Orion. So they make the very direct connection. And they say one of the reasons they can do this relatively inexpensively is because they are already spending money on these other programs. So the $2.6 billion or whatever it turns out to be will not include the cost of, you know, launching Orion on an SLS to go there. It does include the cost of sending the robotic spacecraft that's going to catch the asteroid and bring it to lunar orbit or wherever it's going to be. But it does not include the cost of sending people there.
Interesting. So so the commercial crew is still possible that it could be cut 7%. So could NASA say we don't want to cut anything? I mean, I hear this from listeners all the time, so that's why I'm asking you. We don't want to cut anything from SLS, so let's take the 7% that we would have had to cut from SLS and add that to additional cuts for commercial crew. Does NASA have that authority, or would there be oversight on that could reverse that?
I'm not quite sure which way you said it, but I think that NASA would be very unlikely to take money from commercial crew.
No, it was the other way. Take money from SLS that should have been cut, the 7%. Let's say, and they don't want to cut SLS by 7%. So they figure out what 7% of SLS's budget would have been and take that instead for a larger cut on commercial crew.
Well, again, I think that NASA would not want to take any cut from commercial crew.
Okay.
Because that is the Obama administration's program. And SLS and Orion are Congress's programs that they made NASA do in the 2010 NASA Authorization Act. And NASA, of course, says that they support those programs and want to move those forward. But there were a set of priorities agreed upon by NASA and some key senators. And the top priorities for NASA were James Webb Space Telescope, the space station augmented by commercial cargo and commercial crew, and Space Launch System and Orion. So those are the priority programs at NASA. And one would imagine, but we're not going to know until May 10th, that if there was any way that they did not have to take the full 7% cut from those programs, that those would be the ones that would be protected. But I don't think you can do that for all those programs without eviscerating everything else that NASA's doing, which is why we need to wait and see exactly how they're going to manage this. And, of course, by law, the cuts are supposed to be evenly distributed across all of the accounts and what are called the PPAs, the Program Projects and Activities. So that's the way it's supposed to happen. And you can sometimes you can cut other deals if everybody's in agreement, everybody in the administration and everybody in Congress is in agreement. But like I said, that's why there's still confusion as to where all this is really going to end up. And we'll just have to wait until that operating plan is released to find out.
Andrew is in El Paso, Texas, and he says, to what degree does public involvement matter in what NASA may end up doing or Congress may end up doing? And is there enough public interest on the NASA side to make a difference? I would imagine that even with the traditional group of space advocates and space enthusiasts, the confusion and how the process works is so mind-boggling that it would be really hard to render meaningful and relevant input to whoever is supposed to get that input.
Well, I tell everybody, and I have for all these years I've been in space policy, that you should never underestimate the power of the public, the voting public. Members of Congress listen to their constituents, and if there's even one, you know, for people who are space advocates and want NASA to move forward and everything, it'd be nice if there were billions of people who are going to write to their congressmen or senators about NASA. But even if there's just one person in a congressional district or in a state, they still should write to their members, their congressperson and their two senators, letting them know that these programs are of interest to them. It's really important that people do that, and they can do that individually, or they can do that as part of some of these groups, like the Planetary Society or National Space Society, or you know, if you're you know, a professional in the field, AIAA or AAS or any of those.
You have this from Mary, who is in Seattle, Washington, and says, David, I'm at work, so I'm using email instead of the telephone. I'm wondering if it is possible that this process is so complex and so confusing to most people that to even suggest how best to fund or what projects to fund is pretty overwhelming even to people informed with NASA. But again, I'm wondering how critical is it for NASA funding and budget issues for those of us in the new space community that want to promote a new space agenda. Can your guest comment on that?
The question is, should members of the new space community also make their interests known to their representatives?
No, I think what she refers to is many in the new space community believe that commercial doesn't necessarily need NASA and you can do sort of an end run around NASA and maybe it's not that relevant anymore. So therefore, does any of this stuff really matter if you want to see the commercial companies flourish and open up what they consider to be the space frontier? I think that's where Mary's headed.
Well, you know, for any company that can do this without getting involved in the complexities of the government budget situation, more power to them. So, you know, if you can find investors who are going to put money into it and you don't need to worry about Washington money, then you're probably going to move forward more expeditiously than if you have to go through all this trauma of dealing with the Washington budget process.
How does NASA contributing consulting and non-cash items to a company or a group of companies show up in the budget process? For example, they may consult with Inspiration Mars, but no money changes hands per se or something like that. How does contributing in-kind services or letting a company use its facilities, does that get reflected in any way?
NASA assigns a number of these Space Act agreements with companies, and some of them are funded and some of them are unfunded. So they can sign an unfunded agreement with an organization that says that the organization can use the Deep Space Network, for example, or that NASA will provide them expertise. And in return, they'll get access to the data or something like that. So, and NASA does. So NASA consults, you know, with NASA actually gives money to companies like SpaceX and Orbital for commercial crew and for commercial cargo, rather, and those commercial crew companies. And those companies also have access to people at NASA, and that's all part of the deal. So they do sign agreements to do this, and where there's money involved, then that does get requested in the budget.
What happens to existing science missions? Are there budgets at risk, or are they secure? For example, Curiosity, is that funding secure, or is that subject to a potential 7% cut too?
So Curiosity is now an operating mission, and it's usually 2 years, I think, that they guarantee the operating money for, and then it has to go through what's called a senior review, and they keep looking at missions to see if they are providing enough value to win additional operational funds. So I think the Curiosity is probably in very good shape, and this budget does support building this 2020 Mars rover that was announced in December last year. It's going to use some of the spare parts from Curiosity in order to build another rover. So NASA said that that was one of their programs. Now, again, we still have to see how all the money is going to work out. And I haven't seen, as I've said, what happened in 13. But generally speaking, they tend to protect operating missions over new missions. So I think that what may turn out is that new missions that were in various phases of, you know, conceptual design and everything may get pushed out. But I imagine, and it is just my own point of view, that they will try to protect the missions that are already in development and looking at launch dates, and as well as the operating missions.
We're going to do one more question, and then we'll take our break. And this is from Frank, who is in San Diego, and he says, I'm also at work. But given all of the instability issues, vagary issues, et cetera, how do our international partners plan on doing business with NASA? I think their funding sources and the way they do things are a little bit more stable, even though many of them also are having economic problems. But how does this lack of stability reflect on partnerships with other countries and international space programs?
Well, I think that the U.S. system of, you know, budgeting or appropriating just 1 year at a time has always been a challenge for our international partners. And certainly our long-time partners at the European Space Agency have often commented on how difficult it is to work with the U.S. system because they do it so differently. So there are countries that still do it on a year-by-year basis, but your ESA, with whom we cooperate so much, makes long-term multi-year commitments.
Does the do the added problems we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes or so, do they add to these challenges, or is it just business as usual dealing with the United States, in your opinion?
I think it adds to the challenges of working with us as a partner.
Listeners, we're at our midway point, so we'll take a pause and absorb what we've been talking about, and we'll be back with Marcia Smith in 3 minutes, and I know many of you are at work, but your phone calls are still welcome. 1-866-687-7223. Again, back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to part two of the Friday Space Show program. We're talking to Marcia Smith. We're talking about the NASA budget and the process and some of the issues surrounding that. If you want to give us a call during this segment, our phone line is 1-866-687-7223. And for those of you that want to continue sending email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. I did ask you during the break, Marcia, if sort of the confusion and all of that is at its height this year, or if you've seen this before during your years of reporting and studying and being involved in space and NASA. And you said this is probably about the highest you've ever seen it, right, for confusion?
Yes, I think the fact that we still don't know what the final numbers are for fiscal 13, it's very unusual. Despite all the continuing resolutions and everything that the government's been subjected to over the last few years, to be this far along and to be having the fiscal 14 budget request come out and really not know what's in the column for the current year is unusual and particularly chaotic.
May 10th comes along, do you actually see enough clarification to where the confusion ends, or does it, because I'm a little confused, or does that only resolve questions pertaining to 2013 but not going forward to 2014?
Unfortunately, that's correct. It will only resolve 2013 because Congress and the administration still have to reach agreement on how they want to reduce the deficit. Everyone's agreed that that's the goal, but how to get there has been the source of political controversy, and I don't see any resolution on the horizon. So all the angst that went into the fiscal 13 budget with threats of the sequester and everything are still there for the 14 budget. Since the president released his budget request 9 weeks late, which takes 9 weeks away from the congressional schedule to get it done, and Congress hasn't been able to get it done in time in years, I think that fiscal 14 is going to be very uncertain. I'm sure they won't have this all resolved by October 1st. So it's just getting perpetuated. And until the politicians decide how they're going to deal with the deficit, it's going to continue to be very chaotic.
Ben sent in a note from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and says, David, I'm also at work, so my question is the following. We've been on the 2013 budget, if I'm not mistaken, since October 1 of 2012. So I am really confused as to how we are functioning if 2013 questions aren't answered and stabilized until May 10th. What have we been doing since the fiscal year 2013 budget started, which I believe, again, is October 1st?
That's correct. The fiscal year started on October 1st, and so Congress passed this first continuing resolution that lasted for 6 months that told agencies how much money they could spend. So the agencies like NASA come up with a spend rate for their programs based on that number. But that was only for 6 months, and Congress had to act for the rest of the 6 months. And so they finally did, and the second one really cut the budget compared to what was in the first CR. So these agencies like NASA now are scrambling to figure out how to absorb these big decreases that came about because of the sequester and the rescission and everything, and still meet the dollar number that they've got available to them. And that's why you're seeing a lot of cutbacks and things, because they're having to manage to lower budget expectations in order to get everything to balance on September 30th when this fiscal year comes to an end. And some agencies have been doing it very carefully, and others, I think, have been doing it less carefully. I think NASA's probably been doing pretty good, as government agencies do. But, you know, I think they've got, you know, all these different budget assumptions as to how much each program and activity was going to get to spend, and now they're trying to make that happen. So you see these cutbacks. There's been a big hue and cry about cutbacks in what's called EPO, Education and Public Outreach Programs,
right,
and restrictions on travel and these other sorts of things that they're having to do in order to get through this fiscal year.
So that's the second half of the year CR where that is showing up.
Yes. It was in the one that just got enacted. And that was, everybody talked about the fiscal cliff that was going to happen in January, and they got through that fiscal cliff by delaying action on a bunch of stuff, and they finally got it all done last month in March. And that was, and they kept the sequester. That was the deal that had to be cut to get anything done at all for the rest of the fiscal year. So NASA, like I said, it was cut about $1 billion because of the sequester and these rescissions that were in the bill. And they just have to figure out how to make all the math come out right at the end of the day. And we'll see who the winners and losers were in that, you know, once the operating plan is out.
You know, I do my best, and I'm far from perfect on this, to stay away from partisan stuff on the space show. But is it possible to point the finger and actually assign blame for this confusion to one party or the other, to a group of members of Congress, to the president? Or is it just so widespread and convoluted and dysfunctional that all of these players in Washington are the blame?
Well, I think it is a fundamental philosophical political disagreement over the role of government and the value of balanced budgets. So you can call it blame because things are not getting done. But on the other hand, each party is standing on its principles, which is ordinarily a good thing. So I hate to cast blame on anybody, because although it is politically chaotic, it is driven by fundamental philosophical disagreements. And this is what last year's elections really were held about. And, you know, the differences between President Obama and Mitt Romney, I think, clarified that dividing line between the political philosophies of the voters. And the voters, so one could blame the voters for doing this, the voters decided, despite their very low opinion of Congress and the fact that there was all this gridlock and everything, they voted to keep Congress the same way it was, with the House in control of the Republicans and the Senate under control of the Democrats. And the Democrats even got a couple more seats in the Senate. So maybe we can just blame it on the voters.
So we the people are at fault?
I guess the voters are divided themselves on what they see as the role of government and the value of having a balanced budget versus keeping programs that they think are important. It's very easy to sit there in your armchair and say, of course we need to have a balanced budget. But when people start hearing about the kinds of programs that would be cut or eliminated in order to accomplish that, then they start having second thoughts. It's very hard to do. Very, very hard to do.
Well, does NASA have a history of faring better in one approach or one party than another? Is there a way to say, oh, well, NASA's usually done better, you know, when there's more government spending and we're further away from a balanced budget or something like that?
Well, NASA is a nonpartisan issue. The people who support or don't support NASA kinds of activities, do it for reasons other than their political party. So it's a bipartisan issue as to whether or not you should invest in space. But obviously NASA is going to do better if people want more government spending because there's a bigger pot for them to take money from. And I must say, back in the 1980s, we had a really bad budget time, which you may remember, and
right.
We were under something called the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Act.
Right.
There were mandatory cuts and everything, and NASA did pretty well in that era, all things considered.
Okay, so June is in Portland, Oregon, and she says NASA's not the only government space program around. There's NOAA, and there's DOD with our national security space. How do these programs fare, and are they as confusing to follow and track and understand as NASA?
Yes, they are just as confusing to understand and track as NASA. And NOAA has been under a lot of criticism for its management of satellite programs. And they had a big showdown with Senator Mikulski, who chairs she used to chair the subcommittee that funded NOAA, which is part of the Department of Commerce, and it's in the same bill as NASA. And now she has ascended to be chair of the full Senate Appropriations Committee, so she's very powerful. And she was really fed up with a lot of cost growth and program delays in the weather satellite programs. And she wanted to take them away from NOAA and give them to NASA. But she has relented on that, and there was a hearing just yesterday, and she was telling the acting Secretary of Commerce that she has backed off for now, because the department has convinced her that they've got things in hand now, but she says that the satellite programs at NOAA are on probation because she's still not entirely convinced. And this woman, who's the acting Secretary of Commerce, in whom the senator has confidence, is leaving at the end of May, and they have not announced who they're going to. There has not been a Secretary of Commerce for, I don't know, a year, year and a half, and she's been acting, and now she's leaving, and it's not clear who's going to be leading the department. So the senator was saying, you know, I want to see who's going to take your job to make certain that all these management reforms stay in place. So it is very confusing to follow the NOAA satellite programs. It's just as bad, if not worse, than NASA. And they're building this new polar orbiting weather satellite system. It's called the Joint Polar Satellite System, JPSS. And they had told Congress last year that there was a $1 billion increase in the life cycle cost of the program, and that was one of the reasons Senator Mikulski was so concerned about it. And the senator said, you've got to get the cost back down to $11.9 billion. And so NOAA has done that, but how did they do it? Well, they took part of the program, and they sent it to NASA. So NASA has now got this additional responsibility to build some climate sensors that NOAA was supposed to be paying for. And in the fiscal 14 request, NASA does get a little bit more money for its Earth science budget to pay for building those climate sensors that NOAA was supposed to build. And then NOAA created another budget account for something else, so it's being taken out of the JPSS program that shows up somewhere else in their budget. So it looks as though the program's cost has gone down, but in fact it's just by shifting things either to NASA or to another budget line item in NOAA. And the DOD budget, I have not had a chance to really look into. It's hard to find the space parts of DOD's budget. It's not, they're not all together. It's spread throughout the DOD budget. But as far as I can tell, they are having the same challenges in dealing with the sequester as everybody else is.
In terms of the sequester law and all of this, does the current North Korean rhetoric or issues or dangers, I don't even know how to describe it other than insane, but does it give the president and Congress the authority to override the sequester for national security purposes, and what do they have to do to implement that if they want to do that?
Well, there is always the ability to send more government money, I mean, on anything, frankly. But on something like an emergency situation, whether it's a natural disaster or a war, and that's what they did when we invaded Iraq and went to war with Afghanistan, they created a new budget account called the Overseas Contingency Operations, OCO, and this is considered an off-budget item. So when they total up all the money that's being spent and whether, you know, it's contributing to the deficit and everything, they don't count that block of money.
But where did they get the money? They're still printing it.
They're still printing it. It still comes out of the Treasury. But in all the calculations as to, you know, how much money we've got and everything, as far as I understand it, the OCO money is off-budget money, so it doesn't count in that.
Okay, so interesting. Do you get a chance, Marcia, to actually talk to members of Congress or their staffers about this dysfunction? I'm wondering how they see it from their perspective, or are they just protecting everyone based upon their ideology?
Well, members of Congress are driven by their constituent needs. I mean, that's the first thing that they... I mean, they're obviously concerned about the country as a whole, but they're driven a lot about what's going on in their state or in their district, and those are very important to them. So I think everybody in Washington is frustrated by the situation, but until people are willing to compromise on their philosophical differences, then it's difficult to make progress. It is interesting to see what's going on in the Senate right now on immigration and on gun control, because they are finally acting on a more bipartisan basis. You know, we'll see how it all turns out in the end. But at least on those two issues, it does appear as though some people in the Senate are trying to work together more effectively than they did in the last Congress. And, you know, maybe there's been a breakthrough. We'll wait and see.
Bruce is in Canada, and he sent in another email, so I think it's more of a comment, but I'll go ahead and read it. He says, I can't help that by adding that DOD military space seems to draw more funds, like the X-38 Boeing program, SBIRs high and low, SBX band, space tracking, surveillance systems, UVA drones, etc., which are getting more funding since North Korea started in with its recent activity. Civil exploratory missions like JIMO, J-I-M-O, and ICE planetary missions are never mentioned anymore. So I guess his point is that certain kinds of things get priority funding, and others kind of just fall by the wayside, right?
And it is important, you know, in his comment there to separate. JIMO and ICE are both in the NASA budget, and I didn't know all the programs he listed, but most of them are in the DOD budget, and they really are dealt with separately. The way the appropriators work, and again, the appropriators are ones who actually have money to spend, and they're divided into 12 groups that are called subcommittees. And there's a defense subcommittee that deals with the defense budget, and there's the Commerce, Justice, Science subcommittee that deals with NASA and NOAA and NSF, some other agencies. And they make their decisions pretty separately. It does all come together because the full committee has to vote on all of them. But you would not see a trade-off between JIMO and ICE and something like SBIRS High. The system just doesn't make those kinds of trade-offs. And so JIMO, which was the Juicy Icy Moons Orbiter, is a program from long ago when Sean O'Keefe was administrator of NASA, and it died, you know, after a year or so because it involved nuclear propulsion, which was very expensive, and it just was not affordable at the time. And so that program died pretty quickly. And ICE, I think it's got to be one of the Icy Moon missions. I don't really recognize the acronym so much, but... there are efforts to go to the icy moons. There's a lot of interest in it. It's just a matter of finding the money. And so right now there's a lot of emphasis on Mars, and people are really hyped about Mars, and Curiosity is doing so well. And the Mars community is very well organized, and they know how to come to Congress and say, hey, you know, we need more money for Mars. And that's what they did last year. And so they're very well organized. And maybe some of these other communities need to develop a more effective we'll call it a lobbying approach. I think it's not officially lobbying, but it's effectively lobbying in order to get their missions moving forward. And as the defense budget, as I said, you know, I haven't been able to look at the defense budget request for fiscal 14. I do know that they're planning to cancel one space program, which is part of the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. It's called the Precision Tracking Satellite System, I think. And they have decided to terminate that. So it's not that space programs and DOD are off limits for cancellation.
You have another, you don't have another, you do have a caller on hold that we will take. And for those of you that follow the news but are not following it because you're listening to this show, there is a bulletin that comedian Jonathan Winters passed away. So I'm sure all of you younger people won't know who we're talking about, but for all of those probably over 40 or so, I'm sure you know who we're talking about. Let's hear our caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, David. It's Mike Lister.
Hi, Mike. Welcome to the call. How are you?
Good, good. Good afternoon, Marcia. It's,
hi, Michael. How are you?
Good. It was nice meeting you back in July at the embassy.
Yeah.
A pleasure. Just a comment, and I'm going to jump back to this to the asteroid mission that was. I'll put asteroid mission in quotes because I'm kind of a little skeptical about it. But a lot of us, you know, a lot of us watched that, and I was talking to some colleagues, and we saw this, and we just rolled our eyes and said, you know what, this is just another PowerPoint presentation. This is going to end up being a very expensive PowerPoint presentation because. And the way NASA, back when they first announced their first asteroid mission for their 2025, the rendezvous with the Orion spacecraft, they got everybody excited, like, and they promoted, like, this is a done deal to the public. And everybody was excited about, oh, this is going to be fantastic. And we're watching the thing, but it's not a done deal yet. Then all of a sudden that fades away, and then all of a sudden there's a lot of focus on sending an outpost into one of the Lagrange points. Everybody got excited about that, and a lot of us are sitting back saying, yeah, but it isn't a done deal yet. And that turned out to be another PowerPoint presentation. When this happened, we all sat back and looked at it and said, yep, this looks like another one of NASA's PowerPoint presentations. They're going to spend the money on the study, and they're going to, and it's going to end up as just being shelved as too expensive or not technically feasible at the time. The point is, I think NASA, when they announce these things and they package them, they want to get everybody excited. But when they get by doing that, they really set everybody up for a fall and really lose some credibility in the public's eye, and I'm sure in Congress's eyes too, especially when they don't follow through on their plans and go on to the next great adrenaline rush, as I would probably term it. So I think in their own sense, in lobbying. In promoting these things, they're not really helping themselves by hyping them as much as they are. And they should really be a little bit more conservative in their approach in presenting them to make sure that the public understands this $100 million is coming up. It's about study. It's about technology development. It's about locating asteroids. It isn't about going and getting that asteroid. It's separated. But unfortunately, they don't do a very good job at communicating that. And that's just an observation.
Yes, and I agree with you that it seems a little surprising that NASA would announce programs before they're really sure if they could do them or not. It's not the typical way that NASA has done things in the past.
Do you mean not do them technically or not do them administratively?
Technically, to begin with, and then you have to get the money for it if you can do it technically. But, you know, one of the NASA guys who was giving these budget briefings said, you know, you need to give us time to do the study this summer to see if we can even do it. And he was explaining why it is that they don't have more details to announce at the time, because they've never tried to grab an asteroid. So they need time to do a study and to look at the technology readiness levels of these things to determine if it's technically feasible. And logically, you would figure that out first, and then you would announce it as an initiative. So I'm still unclear in my own mind as to why they decided to announce this right now. It reminds me of 3 years ago when President Obama announced that we were sending humans to an asteroid by 2025. And he was being pressured by Congress to come up with a destination for his new idea. So it was a very, you know, controversial time and everything, so he needed a destination, and for whatever reason he didn't want to go back to the moon. And so he chose an asteroid. But, again, they hadn't done the work to figure out what it actually would take to send an astronaut to an asteroid that's 6 months out or something. And I heard a presentation by Bill Gerstenmaier last summer where he was saying 2 years into it, they were realizing just how difficult it was to send astronauts to an asteroid, especially since they had not even found the asteroid that they wanted to send astronauts to. So now here we are in April of 2013, and they're announcing a different asteroid mission. But once again, they have not identified the asteroid. They still have to do that. And this time they want to go to a little itty-bitty asteroid, which are really hard to find. Because NASA's efforts all these years at finding asteroids, they were looking for the big ones that really posed a threat to Earth. And finding one that's just, you know, 70 meters in diameter or something is going to be a challenge. So now they've got another mission. They're not sure about the technical feasibility. Yeah, they need to do the studies to find out. They need to find an asteroid to go and capture. And it just seems inverted that they're making the announcement before they really understand the feasibility of doing it. From a technical standpoint, never mind being able to do a decent cost estimate to realistically come to OMB and to Congress and say, this is how much the mission would cost if we proceeded.
And I think, and what I find even more disturbing really is that some of the companies that have been formed to actually go after asteroids have been talking about, oh, wow, this would be a great opportunity for us to pair with the government and get some experience. I'm thinking, you know, I think the privates have the right idea. They do have concrete plans, and they have a profit motive. And I think by being too dependent or getting too dependent on government involvement in it, they are really setting themselves up for a bigger potential for failure if they went it alone because I just feel in my gut, after they do this study, they're going to come out and it's just going to quietly fade away and people will ask, well, what happened to it? Well, it was going to be too expensive, or it was technically feasible, or a combination of two, but it was a fun exercise while we did it. I hate to sound cynical, and I've definitely had some arguments with a few people online about it. Especially when they think, and the idea is, it's not the fact that the asteroid mission isn't the moon, it's the fact that the asteroid mission is just a continuing saga of, you know, what I've termed PowerPoint presentations by NASA about, you know, big ideas that really they haven't really done their homework on yet.
And I agree with you. I think that NASA did not do a good job this week in making a compelling case for this asteroid retrieval mission. And it's not clear to me how this fits in with its strategic planning for human spaceflight, its strategic planning for science, or with anybody's strategic planning for planetary defense. And planetary defense is, you know, only sort of a NASA thing. You know, DOD would get involved if there was really an asteroid coming right at us. So I think that there's a lot of interest right now in how to protect the planet from asteroids because of the Russian meteor. And to the extent that a mission could lead to the development of technologies to deflect an asteroid away from Earth, I think there'd probably be pretty much support for that, even in a constrained budget environment, because, you know, we've sort of seen the enemy, and there it is. And if they were characterizing this mission in that way, and, oh, by the way, it will also help us understand, you know, humans beyond low Earth orbit and all this other sort of stuff, they actually might have a chance of getting support for it as long as the money is pretty small. But I think that what Charlie Bolden was doing on Wednesday was emphasizing that it fits in with President Obama's goal of sending astronauts to an asteroid, and that particular objective has not won broad consensus either in Congress or in the space community at large. And so saying, you know, well, now we're going to be doing this thing that there's no consensus on, but we're going to be doing it faster, I'm not sure that really helps very much.
Well, it was my impression that the senator who wanted to give him, you know, give $100 million was really in Congress's mind. And I think what they're thinking, in my view, is this could benefit planetary defense. If you recall, during the hearings they had right after the Russian media incident and the next day that asteroid going by, Charlie Bolden basically said NASA isn't interested in, you know, planetary defense, and yet Congress saying we want to give you money for this, and he pretty much said, my perception was, we're not interested. This seems to me, the money they're giving seems to be, in their minds, to be a means towards that goal of planetary defense, even if that isn't what NASA is labeling it as.
Well, and again, this is another thing I'm going to clear about, because I think that if NASA is going to be successful, they're going to need to pull the planetary defense community in with them and get all these communities, planetary defense, science, and human spaceflight, all behind this mission and all telling Congress why it's essential that they get this $105 million in 14, even though they don't know how much it's going to cost overall. But it was interesting to me to listen to the House hearing on Wednesday, which was right at the time when the budget was coming out, but they were sort of unrelated to each other. But Ed Liu was there from the B612 Foundation talking about his Sentinel space telescope. And he was really trying, I felt, to distance himself from this proposal, because what B612 is interested in is finding Earth-threatening asteroids. And this little 7-meter diameter asteroid that NASA's talking about for the retrieval mission is not Earth-threatening. That's one of the reasons they chose a little one, so that if something went wrong, it would just burn up in the atmosphere. So the communities have different objectives. And I think it's going to be a united you stand, divided you fall scenario. Unless they can get everybody working off the same page, I can just see these communities pulling and tugging at each other and undermining the whole effort.
The overall impression I got is this is more marking time, you know, for NASA, because, you know, the administrator came out and said, well, this is, you know, basically said, quote, you know, this is an inspiring mission. And when he starts throwing words about inspiring and exciting, and it's like, oh, you know, how much is this about fluff, and how much of it is really going to be of substance? Well, the next one. But I hate to sound pessimistic on a Friday afternoon.
That's right, Michael. Go stand in the corner for that.
I'm not a negative guy.
No, you're an attorney, so we cut you a lot of slack for that.
Good talking to you, Marcia.
Always a
pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Michael. Listeners, we are approaching our 90-minute program, so if you do want to call us or get in another email, you need to be a little bit quick about it. 1-866-687-7223, drspace@thespaceshow.com. For what it's worth, and, you know, based on feedback that I get on the Space Show, so I can't tell you that we're representing, you know, the major part of the space industry. I'm not even attempting to do that. But I have almost zero inspiration about any kind of asteroid mission. That almost everyone that I hear from in the space show either wants to do a permanent lunar thing, or they want to go to Mars in one form or another, or there is a sizable group of the community that wants to develop a cislunar transportation system as a priority. But I don't hear anyone getting inspired by asteroid anything. So for what it's worth, that's my feedback.
Well, I agree. I remain unconvinced that there's a need to send people to an asteroid. I'm fascinated by asteroids. And I think, you know, this OSIRIS-REx mission that they're going to launch in 2016 is really nifty. And Japan's going to build a follow-on to its Hayabusa spacecraft, and so they're going to be bringing back samples from asteroids. And I certainly think that finding more asteroids before they hit us is a really good idea. So what B612 is doing, I think, is terrific. And I can only hope that they're successful in raising the money they need to build that spacecraft. And it's interesting to me, both in terms of a spacecraft to find asteroids and also as an example of the private sector moving out on its own. It does have a Space Act agreement with NASA, I think, to use the Deep Space Network. But the money they're hoping to get from philanthropists. So there's a lot about asteroids that is really, really interesting to me, but I just have not been persuaded that you need to have people go there.
I have this email that came in. It's probably going to be the last one, Marcia. This is Peggy, and she's in Cheyenne, Wyoming. I don't hear from many people in Cheyenne. Thanks for your email. She says, last year when you talked about the NASA budget on the space show, on your Space Policy online site, you had very good, detailed, NASA-specific line item budget information comparing year to year. Will you be able to produce charts like that again for your website after May 10th?
I sure hope so. You know, these operating plans, NASA always has to send operating plans up to Congress, but they don't normally make them public. So I'm hoping that they're going to make this one public, especially since it's so critical to understanding what's going on in the overall budget climate. So, yes, I do have a chart up there now, but it just for fiscal 13, it just says pending in all of those columns. And I will be creating one like that for 14 to follow the 14 budget. But, again, we need to wait to see what happened in 13.
When you say send their information up to Congress, does Charlie Bolden physically go there and talk to someone, or is this like an electronic, you know, proposal of 100 pages sent up there to different people via email, or what is the actual mechanism when you say send it up to Congress?
Well, it's a report that they're submitting to Congress, and I don't know for sure, but I imagine they submit it electronically as well as in hard copy, and then any member that wants to be briefed on it can ask NASA to go and brief them on it. And whether Charlie goes or not is a schedule-dependent thing, but there are experts that they have to go up there, and an Office of Legislative Affairs that makes all that happen.
Now, can we access the report publicly? Is it a public report?
Normally, the operating plans are not.
They're not public.
There have been rare occasions when NASA has actually posted it on its budget website. But more often than not, it is an agency-to-Congress transmission. And if you ask NASA for it, they say, oh, well, we sent it to Congress. It's up to Congress to release it. And if you ask Congress, they say, oh, it's a NASA document. It's up to NASA to release it. And then it ends up just never being released to the public. They're very hard to get a hold of.
And if you do get a hold of them, is it considered a leak, or is it meant to be public? It's just hard to get it.
Well, I think that if one is able to get a copy, that it would... I hate to call it a leak. It is meant to be public. There's nothing secret about it. It's not sensitive classified information or anything like that. It's just it's a communication between the executive branch and the congressional branch, and each side likes to retain its prerogatives over that information. But as I said, there have been occasions, a couple times in the past, when NASA has actually made it public itself and put it up on its website, and I hope that this is one of those years when they do it.
What should I have asked you that we haven't covered, or that you want to say more about, or that through my own ignorance I didn't even know to ask you?
Oh, there are a million questions, as I'm sure you know. I think that I probably confused your listeners enough for one day and the intricacies of the budget process in Washington.
What do we keep our eyes on May 10th, and what do we specifically look for on May 10th?
Well, that is when agencies, including NASA, are supposed to send their operating plans up to Congress. And hopefully NASA and NOAA will post them on their website so that everybody will know how it turned out for 13. And then we just need to see how they managed to cope with a $1 billion reduction and what programs got hit, what programs got delayed, and what programs were protected. And I think that will tell you a lot about the priorities of the administration. And then Congress can reject an operating plan and say, no, we don't want you to spend it this way. So we'll have to see how Congress reacts to it.
As always, it's a delight talking to you. And, look, I'd go with you as the guide through the jungle anytime.
Well, thank you, David. It's a lot of fun.
And I want to thank you for being here. I'm sure we'll talk to you again down the road. And I appreciate it. Listeners, there are not going to be very many shows next week, so look at the schedule. Not only am I resuming my teaching at North Dakota, which interferes with some of the show times, but I'm headed south for some family hospital stuff in Los Angeles, and I'm not going to be available for a lot of space show programs. So make sure you check the newsletter. And Sunday is my travel day, so there is no program on this Sunday. So thank you all for listening. Special thanks to Marcia Smith for guiding us through the maze today. And we will be back for sure Tuesday night with a space show program. But again, check the schedule to see what's going on for next week through next weekend. Thank you all, and goodbye from the space show.